Hey, I did have to share one thing, just kind of, you know, in those opening 11 chapters of Genesis, kind of those key events in those 11 chapters. We've noted that, you know, four great events in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, creation, the fall, the flood, and then the tower, and kind of go together as a section. I was talking with my, we were watching our grandkids last week, and we took them out to Pizza Ranch. So, yeah, we ate way too much. And then our six-year-old grandson, Branson, is eating. He has a little piece of dessert pizza and has an ice cream cone, and he's eating. And he says, Grandpa, they actually call me B-Pop. He says, B-Pop. He says, I sure wish Adam hadn't eaten that fruit. And I go, why is that? He said, because then we could eat as much ice cream as we wanted, and we'd never get sick. So it's just the kind of interesting how things are seen through the mind of a six-year-old. Okay, well, we're going through chapter 7 and 8. We've gone through kind of just laying some groundwork again for the flood. We went through the details as we walked through those two chapters. Chapter 7 in particular focuses on the details of the loading of the ark and then that first 150 days of the flood when the waters, you know, prevailed. We talked a little bit about that word prevailed in chapter 7, verse 18, 19, 20, 24. It's a repeated word. And that word prevailed carries the idea of being in command. Okay, the waters were in charge. Everything was flooded. We know that the highest peaks of the mountains that existed in that day were covered with water. Everything was covered. Everything died that wasn't on the ark. It was a universal flood that covered the entire world. Then chapter 8 focused on the progressive receding of the flood. Okay, 150 days, the waters prevailed. Then chapter 8, we have 221 days recorded in that chapter where the waters progressively receded and the earth dried out and finally the mud dries out, allowing the inhabitants of the ark to eventually exit in verse 19. And we've noted that that was 371 days after the flood started back in chapter 7, verse 11. We noted that kind of that repetition on the key, you know, on key dates. They're mentioned specifically, you know, in the blank day of the blank month. So those specific dates really point to the importance of those dates in the flood narrative. And those dates are mentioned in chapter 7, verse 11, chapter 8, verse 4, and verse 5, and verse 13 and verse 14. Again, the key dates in the flood narrative. And I did bring some, if anybody wants a copy of the chronology of the flood, I did bring that one more time. But just have, again, those key dates mentioned, and then kind of just mapping out how many days there were based on those key dates. So just if you want to pick one of those up after class, you can if you don't have one yet. Then in chapter 8, verse 4, we talked about how the ark grounded somewhere on the mountains of Ararat. Okay, the mountains of Ararat, a mountain range along the border between modern Turkey and Armenia. So that's where it landed. You know, it doesn't say Mount Ararat. It says the mountains of Ararat. So we don't know exactly where in that range it may have landed. And we also talked a little bit about how it's unlikely, again, this is just kind of a controversial thing, it's probably unlikely that any of the ark still exists there. We talked about how the timber, I mean, when the flood was over, there was no building materials. So it would make sense that they'd use the timber from the ark for building materials. And then we talked a little bit about how it kind of makes sense. If you remember when the children of Israel sinned and God sent the serpents to bite them and kill them, and Moses made the bronze serpent and put it on the pole and, you know, held it up, and whoever looked up to that bronze serpent in faith survived. Well, then centuries later, King Hezekiah, you know, that bronze serpent survived for centuries. Then King Hezekiah has to destroy it because the people were burning incense to it. You know, they made it an object of worship. We were just talking a little earlier about how ritual becomes such a thing, you know, in life for people. We're idolaters by nature. So you have that bronze serpent surviving and people just worship that. Well, the ark would be the same thing. You know, if they found the ark and it was preserved and it was up in eastern Turkey somewhere, I mean, how many people would be going there to worship that ark rather than the God who made the ark through the work of Moses? So it makes sense that the ark wouldn't be there. And we noted too that, you know, the absence of the ark doesn't impact the reality of the flood, about how, you know, we never found the Mayflower, but we still believe and know that the pilgrims came here and settled things, even though we can't find the Mayflower. We did note, too, that it's not unanimous. There are some who would hold that the Ark or remnants of the Ark do still exist. Josephus, you know, a contemporary, well, historian who wrote in the first century A.D. In his one of his books, he says the Ark rested on top of a certain mountain in Armenia. So this would have been millennia after the Ark, actually, after that occurred. He said its remains are shown there by the inhabitants to this day. So Josephus believed that the Ark was there and there were remnants and they were being shown. Then there's a lot of reporting. We went through some of that by people who say, oh, I took a picture of the Ark from an airplane. And oh, we went up there and we saw some stuff that looked like the Ark and some satellite imagery. Oh, that could be the Ark down in there. But there's no conclusive proof by any of the explorers that the Ark is still there. But a lot of controversy. But again, for us, that doesn't make any difference, whether it's there or whether it's not. The point is the same. God judged the world for its sin. And then he made a covenant with Noah and preserved the world after that, a promise that comes down even to our day. A little bit too, just in an introduction here, but extra biblical evidence for the flood. We didn't talk a lot about that, but there's over 200 flood traditions from ancient cultures and civilizations from around the globe. I mean, they are all over. There's a list, I think it was in, Tim LaHaye and John Morris wrote a book called The Ark on Ararat. And on pages 231 and following, they have a list of these 200 cultures that have a story about a flood. And they are all over. They're in Europe, Asia, Africa, North America, Central America, South America. And these are ancient flood traditions from hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years back. So why would everybody have the same story in all these cultures from around the world? Because it was passed on from Noah and his sons. And it went through, you know, just the handing down of this event. And of course, the details aren't always the same. There's a lot of variation in details regarding these flood traditions. And the further you get from the Middle East, the more disparate the details are. But in 95% of these 200 legends, there's a worldwide catastrophe and its sole cause is a flood. Okay, so 95% of those. 88% of those, there's a favored family in that is saved. And their survival, and 70% is due to a big boat that's built. I did kind of put up here on the screen, kind of underneath the outline for chapter 9, the traditional Chinese character for ship or boat is that one figure there, because you know they do characters. And I get kind of reading that and I'm thinking, so is this real or is it not? So of course you use AI and ask it, you know, what's the ancient Chinese symbol for boat? And this is what it brings up. And then it says, you know, it's composed of three parts. The first part meaning boat or vessel, and then the number 8, and then the third part is a symbol that means either mouth or person. So kind of get a connection there. Of course, ChatGPT, when they're talking about it, that says, this is what ChatGPT says, so again, the AI-generated stuff. It says, put together, these components symbolized a boat with 8 people, which many interpret as a reference to Noah's Ark. This connection is often cited by those exploring links between ancient Chinese characters and the stories from Genesis. While it's not a part of mainstream linguistic scholarship, so the current scholars and smart people don't ever make that kind of connection. It's not a point of study for them. It does say it's a compelling example of how language and culture can intertwine in unexpected ways. So it's like it's there like this. It's kind of an astounding thing, really, when you stop and think about it. But they're like, it's just an example of how things might intertwine, kind of a chance thing. But again, kind of a just an interesting highlight regarding this extra-biblical evidence for the flood. A lot of geologic evidence. I'm not qualified to speak on all of that. Some of that we've talked about in the past, but just kind of those huge amounts of sediment would be what's needed, you know, generated in the flood would be what's needed to make all the fossils. You know, fossils have to be covered. Dead animals have to be covered very quickly if you're going to have intact fossils. Because what happens to most dead animals? Well, they get scavenged, they get eaten, they get torn apart, they break up in the weather. So they have to be covered very fast if you're going to preserve them so that they can be fossilized. And then you can go to some of the resources. There's so many resources. You can go and you can see a fossil of a fish giving birth. It's like that had to be covered very quickly for that to happen. And we talked about that. And when animal footprints, how delicate are animal footprints? They don't last very long. And there's a lot of fossils of animal footprints preserved in the rock layers. Well, they had to be covered very fast for all that to happen. And the universal flood lays the groundwork for these events to happen. The existence of fossils in and of themselves points to this catastrophic flood. We talked a little bit about the polystrate fossils, those upright petrified trees that cut through multiple layers of sediment. Well, how did that happen? Did those trees survive all over the millions of years that these layers of sediment built up according to evolutionary theory? No. They were all buried. The tree was buried in the flood where the silt, deposited by its various weight structure and stuff. So again, just a lot of things in nature that testify to the reality of the flood. Okay, so the flood's over. Noah and the animals depart, but troubles aren't over. And we're not going to really go into this at all, but the increased evaporation due to the warmer oceans, from the lava and everything going on in the oceans, and the cooler temperatures from all the ash from the volcanoes that were exploding, created an ice age. And most young Earth creationists will accept or agree that there was an ice age. There's evidence of that, and it's compelling evidence. And the flood would have set the atmospheric conditions for the ice age to commence. We'd say that the ice age went on for a couple hundred years. Okay, the evolutionists would say there were, 9 ice ages that happened over millions and millions and millions of years. And we'd say one ice age, it occurred over a couple of centuries, and it was due to the creation, stuff that happened during the flood, during the climate that was set up during the flood events. So that fits, the ice age fits well into the flood account. And if you're interested, I talked a little bit about those four. They're called the New Answers books. They're sponsored by Answers in Genesis. They're edited by Ken Ham. And there's a lot of authors in these books. And I think there's four books, and each one has like 20 or 30 chapters on, issues related to creation and the flood in particular. And there's one in there in New Answers Book 1. It's Where Does the Ice Age Fit In? And that had, 20 pages of how it all comes together. So a lot of details there by a guy named Michael Ord. And he's a retired meteorologist, so he goes into some details. Again, I'm not qualified to go into that kind of stuff. But this makes for very interesting reading in your spare time. Okay, so last week we left off in chapter 8, verse 22, concluding that chapter. While all the days of the earth remain, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night, they shall not cease. Again, God's promise that he gives to Noah. They get off the ark in verse 20, and the first thing Noah does is he worships. And God, Yahweh, accepts that worship. It's in verse 21. The smoke that's coming up in this burnt offering that Noah does is a soothing aroma. God is pleased with the offering, and God is pleased with the one making the offering. And then he gives the promise at the end of verse 21, I will never again strike down every living thing as I have done. And then verse 22, kind of in a poetic fashion, emphasizes that truth and that promise. And again, in verse 22, and again, I'm not a English guy, but those you can kind of see real easy that there's figures of speech being used in there, like seed time and harvest, cold and hot, kind of like these contrasts. And the idea is it's everything in between. Like when God created the heavens and the earth, it wasn't just the heavens and just the earth. I mean, it's everything. And this is just a poetic way of saying everything. So God is going to preserve the order that has been created, the normal daily and annual cycles, will continue as long as the earth remains, as long as the earth endures and is here. The earth is going to be blessed instead of destroyed in the way it was with the flood. Now, this promise ends, or changes, is preempted at the end of time, the end of this age. We know that this earth is going to be consumed in fire when the new heavens and the new earth are established. So this heavens and earth ends. There's a transition to a new heavens and earth, and that goes through the process of fire. So again, we won't go into all the details of that. But this promise to preserve things as they are in this heavens and earth isn't violated when the new heavens and the new earth are established through the process of fire. Okay, let's go ahead and go on now into chapter 9. And again, this promise that God gives is dependent on the goodness of God and not the righteousness of man. And we'll see some more of that as we look more at the details of the covenant. And so chapter 9 now, it continues to unfold God's promise to Noah. It's going to expand more fully on some of the details of this covenant, and then kind of a series of truths and characteristics governing the new post-flood world. You know, things are different when the flood's over. The old world is kind of gone. Now we've got kind of this new start on things. And let's go with verse 1. And God, Elohim, blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So we switch here again. Back in verse 20 and following, we had Yahweh. Again, that personal name of God, the personal relationship between God and man, and particularly Noah. Now back here to the, you know, the almighty creator of everything, the sustainer of the creation. Again, kind of ties back to chapter 1. We're kind of doing some new creative things here. And God, Elohim, blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So again, just renewing the command given back in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. Kind of starting over. You know, got 8 people now. We're going to repopulate the earth, and that's your responsibility to Noah's family. Verse 2. Something new. And the fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea into your hand, they are given. So that before, you know, we'd picture always picture harmony existed between man and the animals. You always, you know, see Adam in the garden petting the animals and stuff. And but now there's going to be a fundamental change in the relationship between man and animals. And it's going to be characterized by fear and terror. That word terror is also translated dread. Again, that previous harmony is now gone. And, you know, this fear, we're going to see in verse 3, there's a good reason for this fear. All of a sudden, we get to eat all those animals that before weren't eaten. So we're kind of thankful for that in a way. At least I am. I don't know. A good ribeye steak at Round the Bend Steakhouse is good. I don't eat it rare, so I'm not eating blood. But yeah, we'll talk about that a little while here. But, you know, a key thing for this is, in a way, this protect, one commentator brought out, that this really, in essence, protected Noah's family. You know, there's a new hostile environment now that exists, that's going to exist until the end of this age, the end of the current heavens and earth. So this fear would protect Noah's family from vicious wild animals. You know, they're afraid of mankind. We even see that like out in our woods. You know, there's a coyote coming through. We come out and they run. I mean, they're scared of you. I mean, they will attack, you know, on occasion, but for the most part, there's this natural built-in fear that the animals have for mankind. And one commentator was talking about the dinosaurs. You know, well, what about the dinosaurs? And, you know, man has the ability to poison, trap, trick. You know, man would have the ability to kill dinosaurs. So likely they hunted them to extinction after this. You know, they were dangerous animals, and, you know, so you hunted them, and they'd be able to do that to the dinosaurs. So again, I think one key here in verse 2 is that the dominion mandate that was originally given has not been rescinded. It's just been made a lot harder. Okay, when the animals were all friendly and we, you know, you kind of, come on, guys, and everybody's obeying, You know, the animals are following man. Dominion mandate's a lot easier. Now it's going to be harder. It's going to be in a hostile environment. But a man is still in charge. In verse 2, at the end of verse 2, into your hand they are given. Again, man is in. There's a big difference between mankind and animal life. We've talked about that before. You know, I always feel bad. You see the commercials about the, you know, the dogs that need help, and they're sad and they're starving, and it's like, oh, that's really sad. But you got to remember, they're animals. Okay, yeah, it's sad. You want to treat your animals well, but mankind is over the animals because man is made in the image of God. So there's no comparison between man and animals, and we ought to be focusing on, you know, humankind that need help versus animals. Nothing wrong with helping animals. We've got a cat. We love our cat. You know, nothing wrong with that. We just got to keep things in perspective. There's mankind made in the image of God, animals down here, you know, far lower. Okay, verse 3. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. As with the green plant, I give all to you. However, flesh with its life, that is, its blood, you shall not eat. Sure, we'll go ahead and stop there. Yeah, verse 3 and 4. So again, expansion of the food supply to include meat. Previously, back in chapter 1, verse 29, the diet was specifically vegetarian. That was the original diet. There was no meat eating. It was all vegetarian. But now God sanctions an animal diet for man. Again, it's permitted. It's not mandated. So if somebody's a vegetarian and doesn't want to eat meat, that's all fine and good. You know, there's no problem with that at all. So, and then again, no wonder why the animals are fear of terror, you know, filled with dread and terror of man, because we now are allowed to eat them. And then verse 4, there's a restriction in this, and that's not to be eaten. It's not to be eaten with its blood still in it. Kind of reminded me of the tree, you know, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Like back in Genesis chapter 1, you know, every plant is given to you to eat. Then you get to Genesis chapter 2, and there's an exception. You can't eat the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So there's an exception in there. Same way here with the meat eating, there is an exception, and you can't eat it with its blood. You know, there's some discussion. What does that mean? You know, does a rare steak violate that command? No, it doesn't. That's okay. My grandpa used to eat, you know, we'd go to a restaurant, and I just always remember him ordering his steak, and he was a rancher, so he's a cattle raiser. And he'd go, and I would like it rare, 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 rare. So he'd say it four times. And I remember my other grandpa was also a farmer. And I remember we used to go to his house, and he'd take raw hamburger, and he'd mix it with raw eggs, and then he'd eat it. So it's like, hope you already had breakfast. But those don't violate this command, okay? I think the idea here is, and one commentator talked about it in this way, it really is referring to pulsating blood, not eating an animal alive, like picking up something and eating its leg off while it's still squiggling. So that would be forbidden by this. And then also, too, when you do kill an animal, you drain the blood out, okay? It's drain out the blood. And it's a symbolic thing because blood represents life. And, you know, the Mosaic Law gets into that quite extensively. Doesn't here in this address to Noah, this message to Noah, so we won't go into that real deep. But, you know, the references to the importance of blood, it represents life. And that really serves to foreshadow, you know, and ultimately point to the future atoning sacrifice of Jesus. So the blood is important. It represents life. We're not to eat the blood. So I remember my aunt used to make duck blood soup. You know, it was, it's a Polish dish. I never ate any, so, you know, I always thought, does that violate this command? That's getting a little closer, but it's cooked, and so it doesn't have its life still in it, but there's some controversy on that. It's kind of like a lot of the things we've been studying. We want to focus on the point, not maybe a lot of details that you can get lost in. The point is that God destroyed everything because of man's sin. Now God is renewing things. He's given a covenant to Noah, and he's going to carry that on now till the end of this age. We're under these promises that were given to Noah, and we're not going to eat blood. And you've got to have some conviction in defining exactly what blood is. Is it duck blood soup? I don't know. I wouldn't eat that anyway. We know you can't eat a leg off a squirming animal. You know, if you do butcher a cow, you hang it upside down and you drain all the blood out. But so those would be essentials to the thing. But again, there's some gray area and leeway in here probably. Comes and goes to a point of conviction. One commentator did make this note. This has nothing to do with blood transfusions. Okay. You know, you're not in a blood transfusion. You have living blood that's going into a living body and helping that living body stay alive. So blood transfusions has all to do with life. Okay. It's not blood going into your digestive tract and being, you know, broken down and stuff. So nothing to do with blood transfusions here. In a blood transfusion, you know, the blood maintains all its vital properties for life, which is kind of an interesting aside. Okay, verse 5. Surely I will require your lifeblood. From every living thing I will require it. And from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. So verse 5 and 6 here. Again, I like the emphatic point here. That word requires is repeated 3 times. So it's like God requires. This is an essential and necessary thing. It's, again, very emphatic. And here God establishes capital punishment as a penalty for murder. Okay, this is established before the Mosaic Law. There is no evidence in Scripture anywhere that this command has been rescinded, that is the penalty for murder. It's a direct offense against God because of the impact on his, you know, it's somebody killing his image, killing his image bearer. And again, capital punishment is the only thing that really fits the crime. It's not mentioned here as primarily a deterrent. Some people say, well, it's not a deterrent. Well, that's neither here nor there. You can argue that point. The thing is that capital punishment reflects a high regard and value for human life because life was made in the image of God. Those who would violate that life, execution is what's commanded in this section. Whatever your position is on capital punishment, you know, this is what is outlined here in God's message to Noah. Like one commentator put it this way, he said, capital punishment is not interpreted as a threat to the value of human life, but rather is society's expression of God's wrath upon anyone who would profane the sanctity of human life. So again, this particular command is just as permanent as the promise that God gives. He's not going to destroy the earth in a flood anymore. Okay, well, you're to carry out capital punishment for murder. And obviously there's some implied exceptions there. I mean, an accident. Like if you come to my house and fall down on my rug and hit your head and die, you don't have to be put to death for that. And the Mosaic Law goes into some of that, you know, for involuntary manslaughter and some things like that. But premeditated murder where you're intent on destroying somebody, that would be what's being addressed here. Then in verse 5 at the beginning of the verse there, it's a little bit, LSB doesn't translate that for us real clear. They stick with the original text, but NASB gives a nice note. It's literally your blood of your lives. I like the way ESV translates, again, that first part of verse 5. And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. So the idea here is very clear that it's, if somebody kills, you know, I'm going to require life from those who take a life. I'm going to require blood. For your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. If somebody kills you, they're going to be punished. I'll demand an accounting, one version puts it. I'll exact punishment, another version puts it. So again, very clear here that there's a penalty to be paid for taking a life, and that penalty is death. And then at the end of verse 5, this also applies to any animal that kills a human. And Exodus chapter 21 talks about an ox who gores someone, and then that ox has to be destroyed. So any animal that would kill a human also is to be destroyed. And again, the animal's not a moral agent. Okay, but the idea here is that they've demonstrated themselves to be a danger to life made in God's image. So any animal that kills someone, according to the commands here, is to be executed. And then verse 6, again, kind of going to that poetic fashion. It's written in a poetic fashion, just like verse 22 of chapter 8 was. And some would take this as an early basis for the institution of governments. You know, whoever sheds man's blood, by man, his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man. So is this an early basis for the institution of human governments? And that makes some sense to me. Some commentators focused on that pretty clear, you know, that there would be a responsibility of civil government to carry this out, to convict and carry out. And the New Testament would support that, like in Romans chapter 13, verse 1, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist have been appointed by God. Okay, so God appoints the civil authorities. And then down in verse 4 of that same chapter, for it, the government, is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword in vain. For it is a minister of God, an avenger, who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. So again, if you violate the law, and particularly here in the context of murder, there's a penalty to be paid, and that penalty is death. And it would be typically a government, you know, a judicial branch that would carry that out. So it says, you know, if you violate the law, be afraid. I don't know in our current culture how afraid people are sometimes to violate the law. But the idea here is that the government is an avenger. It's, you know, the job is to ensure law and order. Remember, the reason for the flood was that what happened? Society decayed and decayed until violence filled the world. We saw that all back in chapter 6. And, you know, you got to deal with that. And this is God's provision for dealing with what happened in the pre-flood world. There's going to be a penalty to be paid for crime. Okay, verse 7. As for you, be fruitful and multiply. Swarm on the earth and multiply in it. So kind of a sharp contrast, you know. Criminals are to be afraid, murderers are to be executed, but you, my people, you know, are to propagate and celebrate life. And again, that command's repeated from chapter 1, verse 28, and then we saw that in verse 1 of chapter 9 as well, just that blessing of procreation. That word swarm, NASB translates that, populate the earth abundantly. And we've seen that word swarm show up before, but it was always in relation to the animal world. Here it's applied just this one time to the human population as well. So, and then verse 8, I think we'll go ahead. Well, let's read through verse 8 through 10. We'll get a head start on this. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. So here we have the formal establishment of the Noahic covenant. And it was promised, remember back in chapter 6, verse 18, when God was revealing his plan to destroy the earth, he promises a covenant. Now we see the implementation of that covenant. And that word covenant is used 28 times in Genesis. 8 of those are in relation to the flood. And then 16 of those, the bulk of those, are in relation to the Abrahamic covenant. So we'll come back and visit the whole idea of covenants when we get to Abraham in chapter 15 and chapter 17. So again, this covenant's established with Noah and his descendants, and which ultimately, guess what? We all descended from Noah and his descendants. So this ultimately includes all of mankind. And the benefits extend to the animal world as well. And we've already talked about some key elements of the covenant. You know, guarantee of the preservation of life and the stability of nature. We just covered all of that. You know, establish mankind's power over the animal world. We just covered that in verse 2 through 4. And establishes the value and sacredness of human life that we just looked at in verse 5 through 7. So we'll go ahead and stop there. And then next week we'll pick back up with the establishment of this Noahic covenant. So does anybody have a few minutes for some questions, if anybody has anything, any comments or questions they'd like to bring up? Oh, chickens.
So is this when the ice age would come?
Yeah, we'd say that the ice age started after the flood. So it would have happened gradually. It's not like all of a sudden the ice sheets would be there. But the ice age then would have, you know, started in the colder climates, which would have been up north, and then the ice would have spread over those several centuries. It would have rendered a big chunk of the earth uninhabitable at that time. So.
But obviously people were living on the earth during the ice age.
Yeah. Yeah, I think around the equator and stuff, you know, those areas wouldn't have been impacted. But you get up further north, and they would have been impacted. You know, animals, particularly like the woolly mammoths, they adapted to their environment, which would have been a cooling area up north. So that's where you find all the woolly mammoths, you know, up in Siberia or Alaska or wherever, more so in the cold climates. They wouldn't have been done so well in, you know, Africa where it was hot. So again, that whole idea of animals adapt to their environment. You know, we'd call that, natural selection. Natural selection, you know, that's one thing with Darwin. His whole idea of natural selection, we would accept the idea of natural selection. Woolly mammoths can live in cold weather. They can't live at the equator. So they're going to develop up there. Regular elephants are going to develop by the equator. But the problem Darwin had was he held that natural selection could build new life. Well, it didn't. You know, there's nothing new. In natural selection, you take the gene pool that exists, and we've talked about that before, and you select certain pieces out of that gene pool that thrive in one environment but not in the other. But it doesn't create anything new. The genes that existed in the gene pool were there from the time God created the gene pool, and there's nothing new. There's just different combinations that result in, and natural selection plays a big part in that, sorting out of these genes and manifesting those genes in certain environments. Does that make sense? I'm saying I'm way out of my league, but okay, anything else? Yeah.
Regarding capital punishment, is that something that God intends only the government to carry out? Or what about, let's say, a family member of yours was murdered and then you go out and kill the murderer? How does that all work out?
I think it's not necessarily super clear here. But as we get into the Mosaic Law, there's going to be some restrictions and stuff. And I think that the unanimous consensus would be that it's governments that carry this out. And that's why governments came into existence. And that makes perfect sense, to me at least. But yeah, good question, because some people would maybe go back to that and say, no, I killed them, but Noah said it's okay. You know, God said it's okay. It's like, it doesn't quite work like that.
About Adam and Eve, I just was wondering, what were they, darker than we are now, or what?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that generally, when I was reading through those sections, generally there would be an agreement that Adam and Eve were olive-skinned, that the gene for melanin, which is what does skin color, was in them, and they would have been olive-skinned. And then that probably was the case up until after the flood, maybe even. Because that's when people started to, when the climate changed, and we had real hot and we had real cold. And in the real cold weather, white-skinned Swedes do really well, you know? So kind of people went up north, and through natural selection, the darker colors selected out. So you ended up with white-skinned people up north. Well, on the flip side, you know, the people who went down south, you know, olive-skinned, well, at the time, natural selection would have led to darker skin. You know, the darker skinned people with more melanin would have thrived there. They would have been healthier. They would have done better. So eventually you end up with that particular gene showing itself in Africa, but you end up with the white in the hot climate. You end up with the white genes, you know, manifesting themselves in the north. So we're all from one blood. You know, it's just a matter of that melanin, and how that all manifested itself. And it was through the process of natural selection, adapting to the environment, that created all of that. So, anything else? Good questions. I love the questions. So let's go ahead and close in prayer. Dear Father, again, we want to just praise you and thank you so much for this time together, just so much for the guidance of your Spirit to help us understand your revelation. We know without him, we'd be lost and just blowing in the wind. We do just thank you, Father, for the truths revealed to Noah. We thank you for the way that you're in control of everything, how you've guaranteed that the environment and the, you know, how we live will continue until you return. We just thank you, Father, too, for the just for the blessing of law and order and the establishment of governments to ensure that that we live in a civil society. We just thank you most of all, Father, for the love that you've shown us through sending Jesus to die on the cross for our sins. In his name we pray. Amen.